Welcome back, and we are going to be talking about an important concept as well related to automated testing. It is a lot of things under the automated testing hood, but we're going to give you a sliver of that automated testing pie here today related to open source tools. So what is automated testing? Well, when you create some form of test, you automatically can test that application to know if there's failures or problems with that application, typically right before it runs into production. Now, what is that going to give you? It's going to give you better availability because you found bugs sooner and faster. It's going to give you a higher quality application, naturally, because you're finding more issues with the thing than you could humanly test yourself. And then also, you know, how much you measure this. Well, mean times between failures, or MTBF, might be one way you detect this. So how long has it been since we've had some major problem or thing that has hit, let's say, our production environment? Because that really is an indication of your higher quality of the code that you're pumping out into production. So I first want to start off on a really foundational concept here, because I realize that some of us may not be, you know, familiar with builds. I know this is, for a developer, this is like whatever, right? You're super used to it. But the big question is why do we have builds? Well, the reality is, you know, there's a number of ways you could do that. You're compiling your code. That code needs to be, after it compiled, it needs to make sure it works, right? After it works, you've got some form of package or a build of that software. And as an ops person, right, you need to be aware of what that build is, because likely if you're setting up a release management pipeline, or you're doing some form of automation to create those environments, you need to understand what the build is, where it's at, because you're going to likely take that build code and then push that into your application in some way, shape, or form. And as you can see here in this particular example, we use Visual Studio Online Team Validation Server, which can use TFVC or Git and pump out that build code from those particular build services. You could also, of course, automate things. In this case, we just, you know, show PowerShell. You know, you could also hit a manual build. You could PowerShell script it in there. It kind of leads us to the next conversation. You need to know what a build is before we talk about continuous integration. Continuous integration, this is another topic that Ross and I have talked about because there is some debate, right, on when you say continuous integration, exactly what does that encompass? Now, there are stricter definitions of what we mean by continuous integration, and there are looser definitions of what we mean by continuous integration, but I'll give you a rough idea of that concept here. And what, in a foundational level here, when you go to check in some form of source code control, or check in code into source code, it automatically fires off a build of that software. Now, I would also likely say, in heading towards the more conservative side of continuous integration, you would also likely do some form of integrated tests before you create that build, right? So when you check in the code, it fires off automated tests, and if those automated tests pass, then you have a known good build. Ross, if you have any, comments on that, or does that sound fair enough?
No, that sounds good, and he's pretty close to what we're going to do in the demo.
So. Okay, cool. Okay, so that's continuous integration at a high level in a brief explanation. So what are the tools that we have at Microsoft that relate to this overall automated testing process? Well, the major ones that we're going to cover here in this module is Grunt and Gradle. You could use the Jenkin Hudsons in this space as well, but primary integration points for Microsoft is Grunt and Gradle.
We're building a Node.js application here, and they're very common in that environment. But as you mentioned, so things like Jenkins and Hudson, they're much more common if you're in the Java environment. And there's lots of other tools out there that will do lots of different platforms, etc. But today, yes, it's Grunt and Gradle.
Okay. So what is Gradle? What does that mean? What does it do? This is a more detailed diagram here of how things relate for TFS. And as you can see here, you could have a TFS server, or Team Foundation server, and or the build agent link up and plug into the Gradle server to be able to have it run the builds So if the TFS server, let's say, was plugged into the Gradle server for builds, it could then connect to have Gradle run the builds of the software and still have TFS own the source code control repository and do whatever else you need to do with the Team Foundation server system that's in place. So why might you use this? Well, you know, it provides, you know, some people have their preferences, and maybe you have existing investments in Gradle, and you have specific things with Gradle that you really want to have Gradle enable for your builds. Well, this allows you to, this plugin or the integration we've enabled here, it enables that connectivity between, let's say, your existing investments perhaps with Team Foundation Server and to your existing potential investments with Gradle and your build systems. That link on the bottom of the page gives you more information on this plugin. Shifting gears now, what is Grunt? Gradle and Grunt, got the two G's out of the way here. But, you know, this is also another similar diagram based on the previous one that we have there. And it talks about what does this do, right? Here we also enable an integration point between that Team Foundation server and the build agent, which in this case could be Grunt. And Grunt could then run your builds for you and be a part of your overall process flow for your system. So why might we use Grunt? Well, it really helps if you have, let's say, an existing set of investments in automated testing utilizing Grunt, and that would enable you to connect up to, let's say, Team Foundation server and with your source code repository and utilize those investments in your testing to keep that workflow going and help with that automated testing pipeline. So with that, I want to switch over to show some real stuff, and I'm hoping, Ross, you could help us out here and let us know.
Well, we'll see if it'll work for me, eh?
Well, it's automated, right? It's great.
I've written the code already, so it's automated.
Okay.
And in fact, while you were talking, I did the preparation step, so we're still on the same machine here, and you can see from the console here that I ran, at the very top there, it says the command that I ran, which was sudo npm install grunt CLI, minus G, which basically says, install me the Grunt command line tool and make it available globally to all users. Now, when we were configuring, if we were doing this in a reproducible environment, of course, we now know that we would put that kind of configuration into our Docker file or our Vagrant file or wherever we were doing this to make sure that it was always available to us. And what that's done is installed the Grunt command line for us. Now, so where does Grunt come from itself? All that is a command line that allows us to call Grunt itself. If we go back to our source file, you'll remember that this is a Node application. A Node has this concept of dependencies within it. And when we did npm install, it would read this package file and install the dependencies that we have on there. And I've not shown you this yet because most of the dependencies weren't relevant until now. So we can see the package.js file here. And it has this line here, dependencies, is the actual runtime dependencies. So this is the only dependency we have at runtime, and it's Express, that's the lightweight web server that we're using in the final application. For the development environment, though, we have these other dependencies, and you can see that we're pulling in Grunt, we're pulling in Grunt Shell, which is a plugin that we'll see shortly, Grunt Express Server, which allows us to manage the Express server, JS Hint, which we'll look at, and Mocha, which we'll also look at. Wrestler is another one that actually I realize is a mistake. That should be in the dependencies. It provides a tooling for building a REST API. It should actually be in the dependencies rather than the dev dependencies. Okay, so what do we have when we've done this? Well, I'll show you how this works in a moment, but before, when we wanted to build the Docker image, we had to type, the command wasn't too difficult, but it was certainly more difficult than grunt build, which is what I'm typing here. And what you see is there in the last section that you can see on the screen at the moment is it has in fact built the container. Notice how fast it was because we've not made any changes in the code since we last looked at it. But it also did, further up here, it also did some interesting stuff. Up here we can see it said, JS Hint says that we have our two files are lint free. So JS Hint is a plugin for Grunt that says, check the coding standards, look for common mistakes in this JavaScript code. And I have no common mistakes. I do have a mistake that this can't pick up, but it's actually working.
It's all because you used the lint roller on that code, and it's now been removed from having any
exactly,
problems.
Exactly, yes. I prepared for this to make it look like I can write good code.
There you go.
Then the next thing here is that we see that it's actually running the Express API for us, and we'll look at how that happens shortly. The reason we're running it is because we're then going to run some tests, because what we're talking about here is automated testing. And we have this other Grunt plugin called Mocha Test, and this is running some tests. So we're testing Express in the dev configuration. And we're checking the image API. We're calling get images. And this is what should happen. And indeed, it has happened because there's no error being reported. And here we're recording calling get image rather than get images. This is what we get. And we find ultimately that four of our four tests are passing. And so consequently, we build a new image. Great. So how does that all work? Let's have a look at what's called the Grunt file. And this is where it's all defined. This is where we define the tasks that we want to execute. The config that we have at the top here tells us when we run the Express task, this is what we want to happen. So Express API, that's just names that I can use, and you'll see them later. We're defining some options, and the option that we're defining is we want to run the script source server JS. Same one we've been running all the time. It's not changed. We're just telling it that's where you need to run this thing. JS Hint is the one we talked about that said that I'm writing good code, and we're saying if we call a task JS Hint all, then we want to check all the JavaScript files in the source directory and all the JavaScript files in the test directory. That's why there was two. Mocha test, if we run the test task on this, we want to use the reporter spec. That's what gave us that nice output and comes bundled with the plugin for us. We don't have to configure it. We can configure it, but we don't have to. We get nice, useful output. And we tell it where the files are that are going to actually run the tests. So in this case, they're in the test folder and they're JavaScript files. Okay, so that's the first set of tasks. The next set of tasks are shell commands. So we can run, using the Grunt shell plugin, we can run any shell command that we want. And what we're doing here is we're running the Docker build commands that we had earlier on. So the Docker build task will run the command sudo docker build minus T, which is a shorthand for creating the tag that we used earlier, server, and use the same directory. So it's the same command that we were running manually earlier on. Docker run is very similar to the command we were using earlier on, but we're doing a couple of extra things here. The first thing we're doing is we're stopping any existing running containers. Okay, and that's just to make sure that there is no container running locally on the current port and that we can continue to use that port for all our testing and so on. And then the next line is almost identical to the run that we did before. We're over on the right-hand side here. We're mapping to port 4916 just like we did. We're running as a daemon and we're using the image server. What's different is this switch here. I'm going to come back to this later and demo what it does, but essentially I'm saying, look, I don't care what you've got inside the container under /user/server. What I actually want you to have there is what's in my current directory. So PWD is Linux speak for your current directory. And what this enables us to do is more rapidly iterate over changes in the code, and I'll demonstrate that shortly. We're just saying fail on error. The reason that's in there is if there were no images running and we tried to stop an image, that would create an error. So we don't care about that. We just want to make sure there's no images running. So it doesn't matter if we fail to stop non-existent containers. I'm saying images now instead of machines. Containers. Okay, and then this last one is a new item that we've not seen before. It's a new command. It's called Docker stage. And what we're doing here is it's exactly the same as the run, but instead of running on the local machine, we're running on a remote machine. That's what this --TLS means. It means connect via TLS to a remote machine. which machine in this case is defined by an environment variable called docker host, and that will be the location of the machine that we want to run to, that we want to run the command on. We could define it here if we wanted to, and it would be in this form, TCP colon the domain name, and then 4234 is the port that it typically runs on. So we're not going to do that. I'm not actually going to demonstrate this running. The end effect is that it will, instead of creating a container running locally, it will create a container running on some server elsewhere, some Docker host elsewhere. And that's why I've called it stage. And we'll see why that's important in a few moments. So those are all our tasks that have been defined. These four lines here are just making sure that the that Grunt is aware of the plugins that it has available. Okay, and so the final bit here, this last four lines, are exactly the what we're really interested in. This is where it all comes together. So I'm going to talk about the second line first because we've seen it execute. So this is the build task, and it's saying when the user runs Grunt build, what I want you to do is run the task called test, we'll look at that in a moment, and then run the task called shell docker build, and we looked at that earlier on. It was defined, it's where we ran the docker build command. So the test task is defined above and is made up of three tasks. JS hint, that's where it said, yes, your code is looking good. Then there's run the Express API server, and then we run the tests against it. And each of those tasks is defined up above, as we discussed a moment ago. Next, we have the run task, which we haven't seen yet, but what that does is it says run the tests to make sure that the current code is passing the tests. And if they do, do a docker run command. Now, if you recall, with the docker run, we were mapping our current source code into the container. So we weren't reliant on what was built into the container. We were saying, no, use this current latest code locally. And that gives us a faster development cycle. We don't have to rebuild the container. Even though it's very fast to rebuild the containers, it's still time. And it's great to be able to just run it with the local code as we want. And we'll see that in a few moments. And then finally, we have the stage command. And what the stage command does is says, well, I want you to build first. The build command, if you remember, it says, make sure all the tests pass. Then you build it again. And the stage one says, once you've built it again for me, I know I've got the latest and greatest version. So send that off to our staging server where we can do user acceptance testing and so on that happens on the staging server. And of course, we could have a similar thing in here that would be, say, deploy, that would take it to the deployment servers, and any number of process steps we wanted. So what does that look like? Well, let's break the build. And in fact, I've already broken the build. I did it earlier on in the break to enable us to move forward quickly. And so what we had here is in the server.js file, what I've done is I've changed this ID here. It was 3.8, it is now 3.9. So I'm going to save that change and I'm going to go back to my code here and I'm going to do grunt run. Now you'll remember that grunt run is going to run those tests for me before it does anything. And lo and behold, we have a failing test. Fantastic. And it's telling us that we actually have the wrong ID for this image here. It should be 41438. And since we changed it to 41439, that's not correct. Now, if I was going to do a stage, I think this is great. Let's stage it. Sorry, I did Docker stage there. It should be grunt stage. It's going to do the same thing. It's going to run the test and say, no way am I staging that. It's broken. You're a fool. My computers often call me fools, and this is why. So we need to go to back to our code, fix our code. Fortunately, it's a very easy bug for us to fix. And we're going to do a grunt run. And this time, the tests pass. It's killed off all those processes that we had running from our earlier trials. And I can now do curl localhost 49160. And there we go, we're up and running. It's all good. Just very quickly.
So let me kind of, I have a question here. So you brought up something saying, no way I'm going to go you know, to when you did the stage, no way I'm going to use this test. So can you explain to me when somebody might want to use stage as opposed to just running it? And why would you do one or the other?
Yeah. Okay. So it's likely that you're going to have different tests. So this is an artificial environment that we have here. And I'm running my local unit tests when I run the Docker run command, when I do grunt run, sorry. I'm running my local unit tests, which is looking for things that I'm aware of. But actually, when you go to staging and to other things, there's likely to be other tests that happen that are more robust. So I'm going to want to, for example, instead of testing just this application that I've been working with, I'm likely to also want to make sure that it's communicating correctly with the database, which is a completely different system that I haven't touched. But have I created any side effects? And so I'm likely to have more intensive testing. So I'd have multiple layers of testing. So I'd do Docker run to do the immediate testing on the code that I've just touched. Later, the testing for Docker stage would say, well, do that testing, but also do this load of testing over here, the integration testing. And if you pass the integration tests as well as the unit tests, then stage.
Okay, so that's a very advanced answer to sum it up in a more simplified answer to that, as well as saying, I want to make sure my smaller tests pass before I fire off a longer extensive amount of tests, which might take hours, as opposed to my small tests, which take minutes. So save yourself some time from having a job stuck and fired away and everything running off and it chewing up unnecessary time.
Exactly. Yep. And actually, in reality, though, staging testing and everything, that's likely to be happening at a next level of automation that I think you were going to talk about when we wrapped up, which is hook it into your version control. I would do my local tests here, commit my changes once I see they run, it goes into version control, that triggers the staging task, and will notify me via email or ticket system or whatever if I've just broken the integration tests. Okay. So this is an artificial environment, so it looks the same. So great question.
Okay.
So the other thing I want to demonstrate very quickly is this idea of mapping the code, the current directory directly into the running or built containers. So I'm going to just put hello world in here. And I'm going to go back and I'm going to do a Docker run, grunt run. And this time it's not going to rebuild the container for me, but I'm still going to see my changes, even though I've not rebuilt the container. If I spell the localhost correctly, 49160. And you can see there it's saying hello world here. So I'm actually running my local code without rebuilding the container. Which is just giving me a faster cycle round. If I do a grunt build, it takes it takes a short amount of time, but a longer amount of time than the other one. I'm having to wait 10 seconds, and I'm impatient as a developer. I don't want to wait 10 seconds. I want to wait the half a second that it takes to actually run it using the local code. So we're just building our development environments and making them more flexible by using these kinds of tools. We could, of course, have done that from the command line, but when you do it from the command line, it's more things you have to remember to type, more things you can mistype. I'm even mistyping the one word build here. You know, when you've got to type lots of command line switches and things, it gets more and more complex. So this automation of those tasks allows you to do much more complex things much more easily.
And what is what is the advantage of using Docker integrated in with Grunt here, like as opposed to not using Docker and just having other tests run?
There's no reason we'd have to use Docker and Grunt together. There's no tie between the two things. We could replace Grunt with we could replace Docker with Vagrant. We could replace Docker with just bare metal machines. We could do whatever we wanted to do there. The reason I like to do this kind of thing with Docker is what we were talking about in the Docker session earlier on. It allows me to build a much more complex system right here on my laptop. And I can build a full mock deployment environment very quickly, very easily. But it's absolutely not a requirement for using Grunt. You can get all the benefits of Grunt without using Docker.
Cool. All right, well, I'd love to recap kind of this module here on automated testing. So we've shown you a little bit about how Grunt and Gradle can help with this automated testing. And one of the things that Ross didn't really highlight is the integration points. I touched on it earlier in the diagram. Is this something that we can do with Visual Studio Online or anything like that?
So not online at this point, no. But we do have integration with TFS. So you can hook Grunt and Gradle. We haven't actually looked in Gradle in the demos, but both Grunt and Gradle can be hooked into TFS Online. And the kind of automated task running that we were talking about a moment ago, that can be enabled through the plugins and the code that we've provided for those projects.
All right, we've shown you a lot of different things so far. You know, we've shown you source code control, we've shown you process tools, we've shown you creating infrastructure as code, and even automated testing. But so far up to this point, right, we haven't had any form of automated deployment or orchestration of everything across a number of environments. So with that, I would like to transition to the topic of deployment and configuration management. With this topic, we are going to cover in a little more depth Chef, Puppet, and SaltStack and how this relates to the continuation of the story of doing that orchestration. First off, I want to cover Salt. What is Salt or SaltStack? And this is a mechanism where it enables you to have a orchestration or deployment of these resources from the, you can use either the service or you can utilize the downloadable, installable packages to where then that then provisions infrastructure and also possibly with the master and the client relationship provisions the infrastructure on top of that. So for instance, Azure Virtual Machines and you wanted to install that client, Salt could enable those scenarios. Why might we utilize Salt? Well, it's a platform that enables, right, this level of orchestration in your environment. It could be, obviously, that does a lot of automation beyond Microsoft Azure, and this is a platform to do those types of orchestrations in your environment to help with eliminating, like, the challenges we saw before of having somebody have to manually execute a script to set off a series of things that actually happen. And with the integration that Microsoft has, we have the Salt Azure module that allows developers to deploy, inspect, and destroy virtual machines, and then also employ the power of Salt to manage the Azure infrastructure and virtual machine configuration on top. So that's kind of the high-level view of Salt and SaltStack in the functionality that we're providing. So let's move on. The next I want to cover Puppet. And what actually happens with Puppet? What does that do? So first off, we have a Puppet Master. The Puppet Master is going to allow you to create Puppet modules that specify things like security, settings, and resources, right? This is, these modules are an infrastructure of as code variety, right, that define what things should look like. Those modules then get put into the Puppet Master. That Puppet Master can also have modules that define things for your application, like the SQL, the app, or potentially a web server. And what does that look like? From there, right, you've got a number of virtual machines that in this case have that, you see that little white icon, that has that Puppet agent installed on it. Now, Microsoft Azure out of the box enables an easy Puppet and Chef extension so that when you provision a VM, it's very easy to enable just a default agent on that machine. So what happens is the agents will then contact that Puppet Master. When it contacts that Puppet Master, the Puppet Master, based on those module definitions that we have previously, it will then automatically provision whatever you have defined in those modules on top of those virtual machines. It will make it so. So why might you do this? You know, again, it's a one way to create infrastructure as code. We covered that section up above here, but now we're kind of getting into it later. But it also does something that's also really important, is that it ensures a desired state. So not only does it actually do that provisioning if you want it to, but it also can enforce and say, make sure that this VM is like this consistently. So if something deviates or whatever, you know, you can make sure you can apply that configuration over and it stays in that state that you desire it. So how is Microsoft enabling this integration? Well, we have the ability for within those modules to be able to provision Azure resources such as virtual machines, virtual networks, SQL Server, storage accounts, cloud services, and disks. So you can check out more information there on the link on the page. There's also more information here from the Puppet Forge on those particular modules. So if you want to be able to provision Azure infrastructure utilizing Puppet in your native Puppet system that you may be invested in, then go to these pages here and we'll help you out to learn more. So now I want to shift gears for a second into Chef. These two have very similar capabilities, and I'll give you a different view on earlier you saw the Puppet module, you know, the Puppet diagram where you had the Puppet master and the VMs coming in with the agent. Well, it's Chef operates in a very similar manner. They have different terminologies slightly, but this slide here gives you a different view on that same type of concept and the way it works. So in this case, here inside of Microsoft Azure, what you can do is provision a Chef master server. Now there's a gallery image that we've enabled to just go and fire off and provision a Chef master server. Now when you go and provision that, you probably are going to have some form of modules, and those modules when you are going to then define what that infrastructure looks like. So effectively, when you spin up that VM, again, remember there's that agent extension that's available for VMs that spin up in Azure, that agent will then contact that Chef master based on the definition of what should be provisioned on top of that VM. That VM will then get provisioned with whatever particular resources needs to be there. So again, same type of concept, just now it's Chef showing it in a slightly different graphical visual form. So why might we use this? Why might we use Chef? Well, again, the reasons are going to be very similar to Puppet. You're going to have to ensure consistency, reduce downtime, because the other angle to both of these systems is having a form of monitoring. Right? You want to ensure that that a certain thing is the way it is, way you want it to be. Right. So if anything deviates from that, that can cause problems. And you want to know about that. You want to imply that consistent configuration across your environment. So really, configuration management is huge in helping with your overall stability of your system, as well as if you want to scale, right? If you want to scale to 100 or 1,000 VMs, you know, you have to have that infrastructure as a code foundation, and you have to have the ability to quickly scale and repeatably have a consistent configuration across all those hundreds or thousands of nodes that you may be pushing out there. And again here, Microsoft supports the integration of provisioning using those Chef recipe, you know, commands to be able to provision Azure infrastructure. So now, it's you. Hey, there you are. Yeah.
All right.
So let's see it in action.
Okay.
Let's see some Chef and see what it looks like.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not going to use the remote master to control multiple nodes, etc. I just want to make it quick and easy. Let us get started and see the effects of what can happen. To go deeper, well, that's a whole different course. It's going to take much more than this few minutes of demo. So the first thing that I need to do is have a machine that I'm going to configure using Chef. So we've seen the Azure portal a few times. I'm going to click on New. I'm going to say Virtual Machine from Gallery. And I'm going to, in this case, although we're talking about open source, I thought it'd be nice to do something with Windows Server for a change.
Oh, how lovely.
I know. That's great, isn't it? The same thing would happen if it was Linux. It's the same process, and you can use... there's a couple of differences in the configuration because they're different operating systems. I'll point those out as we go along. But the actual process of standing up your server is the same. So we're going to go with Windows Server 2012 R2 Data Center. And there's nothing special about this. We'll just do something like Chef Demo, which is, I'll put MVA in there because Chef Demo almost certainly will be taken. Give it a username. Give it a password. Make sure I give it one that's suitably complicated. Otherwise, the portal will complain at me. Go to the next page. Not going to change anything here. Of course, you would want to change some of these things if you're doing it for real, but this is the page I wanted to show you. You can install the Puppet agent, or what we're going to do here is install the Chef agent. Now, also, if you're using Windows Server, you have the opportunity to upload a custom script as well. That currently isn't available on Linux servers, but and neither actually is the Puppet Enterprise Agent on a Linux server, but it's very easy to install it on one. But Chef is available on both, so I'm going to click Chef. And what I need to do if I was to complete this is to provide a client RB file. We're going to look at what a client RB file is in a moment. It's basically what defines the initial configuration of that machine. You need a validation key for your subscription, your Azure subscription, because much of what you're going to do with this is going to need to call the REST APIs of Azure itself. You're managing infrastructure, so you need to talk to the underlying control APIs. And you can provide a run list which tells it how to configure. So I'm not actually going to build that machine, to start that machine up. In the interest of time, I prepared one earlier, like all good cookery shows. And here we are.
Quite the chef you are.
Quite the chef.
You are. Yes. You are the chef.
A very unintentional pun, I can assure you.
There you go.
But yes. Okay, so here I am. I'm in a Windows Server machine that has the chef agent installed on it, and I promised I'd show you what an RB file looked like. So here's an RB file. And this file is at the moment, it's only doing one thing, and it's this top section here that we're interested in. It's going to create a file called hello.txt in my home directory, and I'm going to put some content in it that says greeting equals hello world. Now, clearly, meaningless example, we wouldn't really be doing this in production, but consider this as being an ini file or something like that, something that can tell the machine how it needs to configure itself. And that's why I've deliberately done the greeting equals hello world, to show that, you know, we can set values that are going to be used by the machine at runtime. And over here on the right, we have my home directory showing, and you can see there is no file in there called hello.txt. And then in a shell, I'm going to run chef apply hello rb.
Okay. So it might be hard for people to see that. So
oh, yeah, it's a little small. How do I make it bigger?
So if you go to the properties, yeah. And then just go to the
Oh, box. It's the same Change as if I was that. Doing it in a Linux. See, I don't often work in Windows. There we go.
Happy to, that's Windows guy, help. Happy to help you out.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm glad we have all the skills necessary. Okay, so there we can see that what's happened is it said, okay, there is an action to create this file. We're going to look and see, oh, there is no such file in existence. And so we're going to create it, and we're going to make the content hello world. So if I just find my browser, oh, look at that. That file that I said wasn't there before is there now.
Hello.
Magic.
Hello. Hello, chef.
And if I click on it, then I can see that it has got the contents okay. that we intended. Okay, so that's great. We've configured the machine the way we wanted it, but somehow that file has changed. Something's happened on this system. And now our machine is no longer configured the way we wanted it. Chef knows that it's no longer configured the way we want it, because we've told it in our RB file over here that the content of this file should be greeting equals hello world. So I wonder what happens when we run this again. Now, normally these apply things, these would be running on a regular basis, and the configuration would likely come from the enterprise master, which would be telling the machine how it should look. But in this case, what's happening is we're just running it local, just for examples, and we can see it's gone through this and it says, okay, so this file does exist. Okay, what's the contents like? Hang on a minute, it says hello MVA. It's supposed to say hello world. So I'm going to take that line out. I'm going to put in the correct hello world line. So, has that actually worked? Look at that.
How about that?
Perfect.
Changing even text files.
Here. I know, it's awesome, isn't it?
Yes.
So let's do something a bit better than text files. It will do the same. I'm going to delete that file this time. But I'm also going to... come on, delete. There we go. I'm also going to go back to my Hello RB, and I'm going to uncomment these lines. And these lines are a PowerShell script. So it's saying, run this PowerShell script, okay? And what it's going to do is going to run add Windows feature web server, and it's going to use the PowerShell interpreter, and it's going to say, don't bother running this if we already have the web server enabled. Okay? So, oh, I need to save that, don't I? Let's run Chef Apply. And this time it's going to say, is helloworld.txt there? And of course it isn't, because if you recall, I deleted it. And in a moment, it will recreate the file. So that's the same as we had earlier on. That's good. Now it's running a PowerShell script. Oh, look at that. It's running an installation.
How about that? Well, this
fantastic.
This could be much more practical, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
You might want IIS every time you spin up a new node of Windows Server.
Yeah, and now it's happening automatically. Now, that hello text file, if we wanted IIS, probably wouldn't be a hello text file. It would be a configuration file for the web server. It would perhaps be the home page. It would perhaps be another task that would pull in the necessary content from whatever version control it's on, or however you want to set this up.
So to connect that back to the Azure console, where you have the option to specify that RB in the new VM creation. So this might be any number of tasks that you want the base VM to have, perhaps, right? Or even the Chef agent doing certain tasks, right? You could have the Chef agent do things to connect to the master, perhaps?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, you can do that. Now, what I'm going to do, just to finalize this and really hammer the point home, here's me trying to do PowerShell. I until last night, I'd never written any PowerShell in my life.
How about that?
So here I am learning live.
And of course, if you wanted to do DSC as well and be super fancy, you could even do that.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's a really good thing to bring up, because what Chef and Puppet are doing, in fact, is that they are ensuring that DSC is a first class within their environments. So of course, DSC is moving to Linux as well, and that's going to mean that you're going to have cross-platform tooling. You did talk about, when you were giving the overview of Puppet and Chef, that there's these modules and for Puppet and recipes for Chef. And many of those modules will work on any platform. So in the code for implementing those, it says, what platform are you on? Oh, you're running on Windows, you need to run this set of commands. Oh, you're running on Debian, you need to run this set of commands, and so on. So many of these things are cross-platform, and you don't need to worry about it. Okay, so what I just did, if we can go back to the screen there, is I ran a remove Windows feature web server, and it says I'm just restart the server to finish the removal process. I'm not going to do that because it takes time. What I am going to do is I'm going to run the Chef apply again. We now don't have the Windows server. Something's gone wrong. It's crashed or whatever. Maybe we've had to pull that machine out because there's been a problem and we've fired up a new machine. We run Chef apply again on it. And remember that this would normally be happening on a regular thing. It wouldn't be me sitting here saying, oh, check you're in the right state. It would just be doing it automatically. And you see it's detected, oh, the web server isn't running. So it's going to install it again. So very similar to what we were doing with the text file earlier on, but obviously a much more complex set of setups. And so ultimately what I'm doing here is creating more of the infrastructure as a code. So what we did with Docker is we focused on the packaging of containers and the individual containers. What we're talking about here is building up the infrastructure. You talked about how we could set, how we can control the creation of virtual machines, how we can control virtual networks, how we can control storage accounts and all these kinds of things. So we can set up a whole network of machines and all the connectivity between those machines. We can even fire up containers on those machines, Docker containers. So we can use those two things together to manage our whole environment. And it's all just text files, meaning we can put it in source code. So we're right back to where we were right at the very beginning. We can share this information. We can see the changes coming line down the line, and we can have a early and open conversation. We can have the automated testing. Everything's going in the right direction for us.
Okay. What about, I have a slide here which talks about configuration management and Docker using that together. And you kind of touched on that just briefly.
Right.
But maybe just summarize why you might want to use a Chef or a Puppet with a Docker.
Yeah. Okay. So Docker itself is about infrastructure that is not intended to change. It's the idea is that taking down a container and restarting it is so fast, why would you want to configure it on the fly? Just make sure it's configured right, rebuild the thing. If it's gone wrong, throw it away. create another one and bring it up. And you saw that that's very fast to do. Whereas Puppet and Chef and Salt and Ansible and other tools like that, they're about managing running servers, running hardware, running infrastructure, and making sure that it's as we expect it to be. And both have their place. Something like a database, for example, is not the kind of thing that you're likely to rapidly take down and throw back up. You want the database server to be resilient. You want it to change consistently. But if you've got a web farm with a simple REST API like the one that we were talking looking at today that talks to that database, well, what does it matter if one or two of those containers are going down? As long as we can bring them back up quickly, then we're good. So Puppet and Chef and those tools have their place in managing the larger infrastructure, and Docker has its place in managing the ephemeral images or containers that are throwaway. You can use Puppet and Chef to configure your Docker containers. So you could have within your Docker file install Puppet. Here's your Puppet manifest and run it, and it would be exactly the same as we've just seen with Chef, or almost exactly the same as we've just seen with Chef. And it does have some advantages because you've only got one set of configuration files to worry about. Everything's happening in Puppet or everything's happening in Chef. But it also has some disadvantages as well. And so I would say it's advisable to use Puppet and Chef for your infrastructure management. And you may want to use it for your configuration management of individual containers. But the Dockerfile is often sufficient for that use case and brings some advantages with the speed of operation and so on.
OK. All right. So I think we've kind of covered some of the scenarios here. So just a recap here is a second slide on, you know, just summarizing what you just mentioned here in these two slides. And I'll just listen there for you to read and check out it later for what he summarized. But let's kind of recap on this overall module.
Actually, there is one point I forgot to make where I see the slide on there. The very last bullet on that side indicated where it can be a good idea to use Puppet and Chef and tools like that inside of your containers. I've been talking about one of the advantages of containers being that I can set up my whole infrastructure on my laptop. I can have 10 different containers, 20 different containers, and my laptop can cope with that. But when I go to deployment, it might be that not all of those are going to be containers. And in that situation, if I use Puppet or Chef to configure the container, that same configuration file can be used to create a configuration of a virtual machine or a Vagrant virtual machine image or any other tool, whereas a Docker file is only useful for creating a Docker container. So where you know you want to have it Docker in a development environment and maybe a staging environment, but you actually want to move to VMs for some components in a production environment, that's a really good use case for using Chef or Puppet or another tool for managing the container itself.
Yeah, I think just to kind of give another angle or hash on what you're saying, you know, Docker is great at provisioning the containers themselves and making sure those are consistent. When you get to the actual infrastructure itself that's underneath Docker, like a virtual machine or whatever, or something that may not, something for your application that you may need to use that's not inside of a container, like a SQL server, perhaps that you want to run on an actual VM, or maybe even you want to spin up a cloud service or something else that that Puppet or Chef can do, then that's where you probably want to use the combination.
Yeah, that's a nice summary of my longer answer.
Okay, cool. All righty, cool. So so let's kind of recap here then on this overall module. You know, the big high-level point is that there are a lot of different ways to deploy and ensure consistent configuration in your environment, right? We threw out PowerShell DSC, Puppet and Chef have both a way to do consistency there, and as well as, you know, kind of tying back to the infrastructure as code, which we've kind of brought into here as well. There's a number of ways where you can configure your infrastructure and configuration as code, including, you know, Puppet and Chef being a couple of those different ways. So, but this so far, right, has really given us everything up until this point of, well, what if I want to release multiple updates to the application, right? It doesn't quite address that. So we've now got a little more of a way to automate and provision things, but we don't quite have that. If I want to deploy 40 more updates to my app, what do I do? How does that work, right? If I want to enable a continuous deployment pipeline of my application, what could I do there, right? And then last but not least, you know, how do I monitor those applications? And that's what we're going to do coming up next, right after the break. So stay tuned.